The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones that we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, February 17th, 1946, we present the 14th in the distinguished new NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today:
the proud history, the fighting tradition of the United States Marine Corps.
And the question:
what now for the Marines?
This is Robert St. John in New York. It was just 1 year ago that it began. A year ago yesterday that a powerful naval task force began shelling Iwo Jima. It will be a year on Tuesday since the Marines went ashore at Iwo. Historians may claim that true perspective is impossible after only a year. Well, maybe that's so. But Iwo was not an event in itself. It was a bloody, brave, terrifying, inspiring climax of 165 years of service. It was a fulfillment of Marine Corps destiny.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington, and here in our nation's capital, the epic of courage and devotion that was the Battle of Iwo is still being recalled. And right now, many of the country's lawmakers are wondering what place in the post-war world should be held by the service that pried open the gate to Japan. And here with me today to tell the National Hour about the Marine Corps, its magnificent past and its future, is Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal. And we will also call in the Corps Commandant, General Alexander A. Vandegrift. We are standing by.
This was their path.
Guadalcanal.
These are the strides that drove a treacherous foe back to his home island.
Tarawa.
Yielding his stolen empire as he reeled backward.
Bougainville. Cape Gloucester.
These names represent space, time, atoll.
The Marshalls.
Defenses, obstacles, reefs, tides, jungles.
Saipan.
All the factors the Japanese counted on in their decades of planning.
Tinian.
They were overcome by specialized knowledge, incomparable tradition, coordination, machines, and men.
Guam.
Hello.
Brave men with fighting hearts.
Iwo Jima.
The feats were merely what we expected of the Marines.
Okinawa.
And only the enemy was surprised.
The speed with which you trained powerful amphibious forces was a complete surprise to us.
This is Captain T. Omae, Imperial Japanese Navy, speaking after the final defeat of Japan. Captain Omae should not have been surprised. This Marine force that swarmed ashore on Japan's heavily fortified islands had cumulative training of over a century and a half. Now let's take a long look back to see where the advance on Tokyo really began, to see the men and the deeds that made the advance possible. ...1776. The forces of colonial freedom, poorly supplied, wretchedly armed. The commander-in-chief of the Continental Fleet was Commodore Essex Hopkins. Secret information brought to him by Continental Intelligence stirred his imagination as he paced the deck of his flagship.
600 barrels, you say?
Yes, Commodore, at least 600 barrels of powder and other ammunition.
And the British have them stored in the Bahamas?
Aye, the island of New Providence.
Does your information give any indication of the force that defends the store?
Small, sire, a small force.
Then with the squadron and the marine contingent...
The only harbor is under the guns of Fort Nassau.
Perhaps it'll be possible to land in force elsewhere than in the harbor.
Perhaps.
By the Lord Harry, with 600 barrels of powder, and so dire our need for powder, it's worth the trying.
The squadron moved down Chesapeake Bay, was fitted out for the expedition, and set sail for the Bahamas in January. On March the 1st, it reached the rendezvous at Abaco, one of the Bahama Islands. Commodore Hopkins had laid his plans carefully, and now he set them into operation.
You, Lieutenant Weaver, will command the two sloops. It will be your purpose to put Captain Nicholas here ashore with his marine.
I understand, sir.
In this way, Captain Nicholas, you will have the advantage of surprise. Move your marines ahead of the squadron. Then, Captain, if you fail to get the full advantage of surprise, the squadron will come up to support you. Is everything understood?
Aye, Commodore. It is my task to put Captain Nicholas and his marines ashore.
And the rest, as I take it, is left to my marines.
That is the cannon of the fort, Captain.
Our movement has been detected, Lieutenant. The squadron followed too closely. I can't put my men ashore here.
We'll move to the eastern end of the island.
The advantage of surprise has been lost. But if you'll engage the shore forces with the cannon, we'll fight our way ashore.
Aye, aye, sir.
That is how it was done 169 years before Iwo Jima. The sloops Providence and Wasp lay off New Providence, and under the cover of the gunfire of the two vessels, Nicholas and his force went ashore. The Marines had landed.
Here in Washington, old yellowed file papers in museum cases tell of the innumerable occasions on which the Marines have landed. And through this record, there is the step-by-step series of discoveries, developments, refinements of method that increase the striking power of this military arm of the United States Navy. Now, we call to your attention this man. Washington files indicate that he may have been the first casualty in the war with Japan. What he is writing will give you the idea of how early he began the battle.
Advanced Base Operations in Micronesia by Major Earl H. Ellis, United States Marine Corps, 1921. It is my opinion that the Japanese...
Major Earl H. Ellis, after making a brilliant record for himself in World War I, was not convinced that the world had seen its last war. Earl Ellis knew the Japanese. He'd been in Guam and the Orient even before the First World War. He'd seen omens and portents in the behavior of the Japanese. The first that Ellis's superior knew of this uneasiness was when a manuscript was placed on the desk of the Marine Commandant, then Major General John A. Lejeune.
Advanced base operations in Micronesia. What's this, Major?
I'd like you to look it over, General.
But operations in Micronesia? What sort of a problem is this?
It's not a theoretical problem, sir. I firmly believe that we'll have to fight a war someday out there in the Pacific.
Great Scott. Against whom?
Japan, sir.
Are you serious about... Yes, I can see you are.
That's just an outline you have there, sir. But if you'd approve, I'd like to expand it. I'm sure they're preparing these Pacific islands at bases and are fortifying them, sir.
Well, that would be important intelligence, if true, Ellis.
Something is going on in those islands. I've heard from men at Guam that it's now almost impossible for an outsider to visit on any of the islands the Japanese took over from Germany.
But are you certain they want to fortify positions so far from their mainland? Well, the marshals are at least 3,000 miles from Japan. Why do you think they'd go to the trouble of defending a few relatively unimportant islands that far from their shores?
I don't believe they have defense in mind, sir.
You mean you think they would attack us?
I do, sir.
Ellis, I'm not sure I agree with you entirely as to the possibility of this thing, but if you feel strongly about it...
I do, sir.
Well, what do you recommend, Major?
Ellis, a tall, well-built Kansan of slightly over 40, went to work on his plan for defense operation against Japan with astounding thoroughness. And here are some of the things he wrote in his report of 1921.
In order to impose our will upon Japan, it will be necessary for us to project our fleet and land forces across the Pacific and wage war in Japanese waters. During the first phase of the operations, the enemy will endeavor to reduce our fleet superiority to a limit where he believes he can safely risk a main fleet action. Considering our consistent policy of non-aggression, Japan will probably initiate the war, which will indicate that she...
Well, Ellis, this is a very impressive piece of work you've done. Excellent detail.
Thank you, General. But it isn't nearly so detailed as I think it should be. Actually, we know nothing at all about these islands.
Yes. I believe we should know more about them.
It can't wait, sir. Every day, the Japanese are closing up that part of the world tighter and tighter. It'll have to be done before the curtain is drawn completely.
But I doubt if the State Department will approve any secret expedition.
Well, sir, I'd like to see this thing through myself. If you would give me an extended leave of absence...
Now, wait, Major. Even if the leave could be arranged, I don't think money could be appropriate.
I have money of my own, General Lejeune. I can get a job with one of the trading companies. That will bring in something, and the job will take me where I want to go.
Evidently, Major, you're completely convinced of the urgency of this.
I am, sir. It may be tomorrow, it may be 50 years from now, but someday, Japan is going to strike.
Earl H. Ellis, by then a lieutenant colonel, was given an extended leave of absence and left immediately for Micronesia.
And guess who I saw in Tokyo? Earl Ellis. Yes, when he saw me, he gave a little shake of the head like he didn't want me to speak to him. What's he up to?
I haven't heard from Ellis. Last letter I had from him, I got a year ago March.
Yeah, every once in a while, some Marine comes back from Guam or someplace out there and says he's seen Colonel Ellis. We haven't heard from him here for over 2 years.
A report came in late spring of 1923. Not from Ellis, but rather about Ellis.
Mr. R.H. Ellis, believed employee of a foreign trading company, accidentally killed Palau Islands, May 12th.
Inquiries by the State Department addressed to the Japanese government brought a different story.
Deeply regret to report Mr. E.H.S. died of natural causes. His body has been cremated. Deeply regret.
And shortly after this report was received, the cruiser Milwaukee, on its shakedown cruise, stopped at Palau to investigate Earl Ellis's death. The Japanese officials said he had died of excessive drink. Now, that's all that was said officially, but there was talk in Palau of poison. That's the end of the story of Colonel Earl Ellis, who more than 20 years before Pearl Harbor accurately foresaw the Japanese aggression. That's the end of the story, except for one incident in 1944, after we had captured these islands from the Japanese. A bulldozer preparing an airfield on Palau rooted out a grave marker. The driver of the bulldozer said the name on the marker was Ellis.
Regret to report Mr. E.H.S. died of natural causes. His body has been cremated. Deeply regret.
Perhaps then Ellis was the first Marine casualty in our war against Japan. But he is not the only man who had a part in preparing the Leathernecks for that very specialized job of landing from the sea on a defended shore, nor was the path to general acceptance of amphibious warfare a cheap one. The first obstacle was the past, for other men had tried these tactics and had failed.
I tell you, it's impossible. Gallipoli has demonstrated that a large-scale landing on a defended shore has been made very nearly impossible by the invention of automatic weapons. such as the machine gun.
Yes, the British disaster at Gallipoli made some military men think that such landing operations were impossible. The U.S. Marine Corps did not accept that as a verity, for it would have marked the end of the Marines. There were solutions to the problem, and with experimentation, the Marines found them.
Hey, that's too easy. Take that Amtrak down the beach away. Try to climb out with a shingle. It's really steep.
Don't worry. This baby can climb out of anything. Over anything, onto anything.
The amphibian tractor landing vehicle tank, the LVT, was one of the answers to workable amphibious tactics. The LVT could be armored to protect personnel against small arms fire. It could be maneuvered in the water and on the beach. Then came the development of the LCVP, the LCI, the LCM, all contradictions to the belief that amphibious operations had no place in modern warfare.
Guadalcanal.
Well, we've started. We showed them we can land against them, but it was rugged.
Cape Gloucester, Emerald.
I've had a year and a half of it, death and disease, hacking through the jungle. But we're getting there. We're nearer Japan.
Roy, Namur, and the Waitop.
We smacked them back from there.
The Marianas, Saipan, Tinian, Guam.
The B-29s to go after Tokyo and we got through. But the soil on those islands was a lot redder afterwards than it was before.
Iwo Jima.
Somehow they knew it. On the way there, they knew that this was to be the big show. The Leathernecks knew it, in fact, as soon as they were on the transports.
We're going to be on this ship for a month of Sundays.
Yeah? How do you know?
We need a way to keep us busy. That's to keep us from going stale.
Oh.
Now, if we just sat around here... Uh-oh. That clinches it.
Huh? What clinches it?
Here. See what's coming over in the wash line with the destroyer?
Yeah, but what is it?
The sealed office. The officers get briefed, and then it comes to us. The good news.
Then the future unfolded, as much as the future can unfold while it's still the present. Every detail is covered in the officer's briefing.
Well, this is it, gentlemen. Iwo. It's a volcanic wart, and we've never come up against anything quite like it. We know the enemy's defense will unravel if they lose Iwo. And the enemy knows that, too. So we're not expecting a picnic. Now, here's the beach we're going to hit. The East Beach. It's about 3,000 yards from here to here. Now, we're on this south sector, north of Mount Suribachi here. This is the green beach. This is the red. The 28th Regiment will hit the green. The 27th will hit the red. H hour, minus two. The LCIs, the LSTs, the LSNs.
Now look, guys, look. Get this right if you want the long end of the odds. What'd I tell you now? Who's on our right?
Second platoon, Charlie Company on our right.
Yeah, you got that straight. Who comes in the next wave after we do?
Battery Dog behind us.
Who's on our left?
Who's on first?
What's on first? Who's on third?
Okay. So you're Abbott and Costello. I just hope you remember the funny jokes when you're in a crossfire and you don't know who's where.
Yeah, that's right. Come on, guys. This is something we can't miss.
Everything's pat down to the last detail except for one, the unpredictable, the weather. Midnight of February 18th. 9 hours till H hour, and the Pacific was rough. 6 hours later, the seas were calm. And then came the dawn. Dawn, and the Marines got their first look at Iwo. The New York, the Arkansas, the Texas, the Idaho, the Nevada, the Tennessee were pounding the shore.
0730.
Here we go, chump. Over the side.
Eddie, who's on our right? I forgot.
Yeah, take it easy. First platoon.
Oh, yeah.
0756.
Flagship.
Let's have it.
Very light swells, light surf, excellent visibility.
0811.
Lift the fire when first wave landing craft is 500 yards offshore. The SPDs will go in low to bomb and strafe beach installations.
3-0.
There's the signal. First wave starts in, others to follow at 2-minute intervals. How you feel, chum?
I can't remember anything, Eddie.
Yeah, you will. It'll all come back to you when you hit the beach.
0849.
Golly, it's quiet. After that barrage.
I didn't think it'd be anything like this.
9 o'clock. 0900 hours. February 19, 1945. 8 hour.
History takes over from this point to tell the terrible, glorious story. And history fails, too, for the mind can't encompass an event of this magnitude. 60,000 Marines went out to take Iwo. 20,000 of them were killed or wounded taking it. Why did it have to be done? Well, we needed Iwo to speed the victory. Why did the Marines do it? Because it was an operation for which the United States Marine Corps had been preparing for 169 years.
At our National Hour microphone, to honor the men of his command who gave their lives at Iwo, is the Commandant of the United States Marine Corps, General Alexander A. Vandegrift. Today, from NBC's affiliated station, WTMA in Charleston, South Carolina, General Vandegrift.
I am honored to participate on this occasion of the anniversary of Iwo Jima in a tribute to the men whose gallantry is symbolized by the now familiar picture of that heroic group raising the stars and stripes over the rocket summit of Mount Suribachi. But I should like also to pay tribute to other men, men like Colonel Ellis, who were present only in spirit at the assault on Iwo, but whose contribution to victory was as vital as that of the men whose valor and skill took that impregnable island. They are the Marines who preceded the generations which stormed Iwo. They are the men who landed with Major Nicholas at New Providence in 1776, or raised the American flag at Derna in North Africa in 1805. They are the Marines who, following First World War, applied themselves anew to the study of that most difficult of all military operations, a landing from the sea. These Marines, both officers and men, worked doggedly, quietly, and alone in the practical and theoretical development of the art of amphibious warfare. They evolved over the years an extensive and authoritative written doctrine, and when it finally became clear that amphibious action was to be the key to World War II, their doctrine and equipment were shared with our Army and with our allies. Iwo Jima represents a fruition of individual and collective experience, thought and effort of many thousand Marines, past and present. They are the soldiers of the sea in whom reposes the tradition of amphibious operations, laid to rest the view which prevailed in military circles prior to the war, that operations involving landing on a defended beach became impractical with the advent of automatic weapons. They demonstrated that no beach, however strongly defended, can be held in the face of a well-organized and resolute assault from the sea. This is a fact of vital significance to any nation whose security depends upon the maintenance of supremacy on, over, and under the seas which lie between it and any possible aggressor. The ability to conduct successful and amphibious operations is a necessary and inevitable adjunct of sea power. Marines of the future, like those of the past who pioneered amphibious warfare, and those of the present who brought it to its highest peak at Iwo Jima, will continue to contribute to control of the seas as maintained by the United States Navy in the interests of our national security.
Thank you, General Vandegrift. Down here in Washington, legislation is coming up affecting the future of the Marines. Recently, Senator Brian McMahon of Connecticut introduced a bill proposing that Because of the Corps' great versatility and because by tacit international understanding, the use of Marines does not constitute an act of war, the bill proposes that the Congress place the United States Marines in the hands of the international police. So Congress may give this job to the Marines, but regardless of this proposal, the Navy Department has definite plans for the Marine Corps in its post-war program. And to tell you how he feels about these plans, the National Hour brings you now the Secretary of the Navy, James V. Forrestal.
Iwo Jima has become one of the great place names in the glorious history of the United States Marine Corps. Admiral Turner called it the most heavily fortified and capably defended enemy island in the world. Its defenders were destroyed by the Marines, supported by ships and planes and men of the United States fleet, a trifibious task performed by a trifibious task force. It was my privilege to be at Iwo on D-Day, minus one. I clearly recall the impression of that dark and brooding island, and as clearly as if it were yesterday, I see the stars and stripes 3 days later going to the top of the flagpole on Mount Suribachi. That island was only 8 square miles in area, but it was a vital point on our road to Tokyo. Uncommon valor was a common virtue of the 3rd, 4th, and 5th Marine Divisions on Iwo. Their record of dauntless courage should never be forgotten. It was not only uncommon valor that won the Battle of Iwo, or any of the other battles that were fought on these coral and volcanic islands. Those victories had their roots in far-sighted planning and training typical of the Marines. The smooth teamwork of modern amphibious assault was being developed in the Caribbean area 20 years before most Americans ever knew that there was an island called Iwo Jima in the western reaches of the Pacific. And by the time the Fleet Marine Force went ashore at Iwo, its technique was so organized that even the loose black sand on those beaches and the skillfully concealed Japanese pillboxes beyond the slope could not repulse the attack. Each landing in the Pacific contributed to the success of the next operation. The United States Marines are specialists, and they are also all-around fighting men. They know how to spearhead attack. They have plenty of experience in the protection of American lives abroad in peacetime. The familiar phrase, "call out the Marines," is no idle invocation, and its force and meaning must not be lost. Speaking as an individual citizen, I must confess that this possibility worries me. Some of the current proposals for changes in the character of our armed forces seem to me to risk the submergence of the role of the Marine Corps and lessening that morale which has given this Corps its extraordinary fighting proficiency. I cannot help thinking what a loss our country would suffer if the particular and singular identity of the Marines ever disappears. Whatever the future composition of our armed forces may be, the fighting efficiency and the high spiritual quality of the Marines must not be impaired. National security is paramount, and the United States Marine Corps is a proven guarantor of that security.
Thank you, Mr. Forrestal.
On the subject of the United States Marines, then, our documentary is ended.
But this is Robert St. John inviting you to listen again at the same time next week when our subject will be The Railroads of America, What Travelers May Expect in the Future.
This has been The National Hour. From our studios in New York and Washington and from station WTMA in Charleston, South Carolina, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the 14th in a distinguished new series on national problems and current affairs. Our speakers today were Secretary of the Navy James P. Forrestal and General Alexander A. Vandegrift of the United States Marines. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.